Chapter 7. The Istuli Plains. A quote from Qualis on the Invitic Sages. And they scoff at heroes, saying that fate serves disaster to many and feasts to few. They claim that willing is but a form of blindness, the conceit of beggars who think they wrest alms from the jaws of lions. The whore alone, they say, decides who is brave and who is rash, and who will be hero and who will be fool. And so they dwell in a world of victims. A quote from Cassidus, Annals of Cannae. Ever do men use secrets to sort and measure those they love, which is why they are less honest with their brothers and more guarded with their friends. Late Spring, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk, the High Istuli. They had fled, and they had gathered, like sawdust before the sweep of the carpenter's hand. Shrank. The clans had infested the Sarkarpi Pale, had fled long before the great ordeal trod their nourishing earth. They, unlike their wilder cousins to the north, had long, hard experience with the cunning ways of men. And they knew the folly of closing for battle absent overwhelming numbers, so they fled where other clans would have raced gibbering to their doom. They fled bearing the word of the dread Isra-Z-Horal, the shining men, who marched with word-cracking strength behind them. Their cousins to the north heeded them, as did their cousins in turn. Hundreds became thousands, became tens of thousands. So the clans fell back, ever back, wincing from chance encounters with mannish pickets, forming a rind that grew ever more raucous with numbers as it retreated across the empty leagues, and growing ever more hungry. What began as the flight of a few scattered clans soon became a shrieking migration. The parching wind whipped high the dust of their discord, raised veils of arid filth to the arch of heaven. The sun was blotted. The Shrank teemed as insects across the obscured flats and shallows. So many the land became desert waste in their wake, stamped and scratched into lifelessness. And as their numbers swelled, so did their fear of the shining men dwindle. Shortly after the breaking of the ordeal, General Sibawul Tainurwal, intent to demonstrate the skill and daring of his Sepulorans, disobeyed the orders of Prince Kaiutus, and rode far ahead of his fellow Kidruhil pickets. He would be the first among men to lay eyes on the storm brewing in the Istuli wastes. There was no question of giving battle, for the inhuman multitudes blackened the circuit of all that could be seen. A full third of his riders fell that day, for the fleetest among the Shrank were quicker than the slowest among the Sepuloran riders. Sibawul and his Sepulorans raced, fleeing toward their fellow pickets, drawing thousands in pursuit, and a running battle, the first since the fall of Sarkopus, was fought as the Kidruhil companies scrambled to fend them. Several hundred cavalrymen were lost before the day's end, a needless waste. When Sibawul was brought before Kaiutus, the Prince Imperial rebuked him in the harshest terms, saying that the Aspect Emperor had known of the hoarding all along. But realizing the ardor this knowledge would spark in the hearts of his men, he waited for the most opportune time to inform the sacred host. "How do you, a master of men, punish those who disobey your commands?" Kaiutus asked. "Flogging," Sibawul fearlessly replied. So was the first lord of the ordeal, whipped for a martial transgression. And so did the Zaduyani learn that beyond the northern horizon, their foe roiled in numbers that encompassed the horizon, numbers far greater than their own. About the campfires, those who had argued a bloodless march to Golgotharath were silenced. No one could deny that a grievous toll was about to be paid. King Nersae Proyas had seen the way hosts accumulate infirmities more times than he cared to remember. Supplies dwindled, spirits flagged, Diseases multiplied, and so on, until armies that once appeared invincible came to resemble doddering old men. There was the war against the Tidoni Orthodox, of course, and the disastrous campaign across the Sekarib Plains, where he had almost succumbed to the fevers. But more and more he found himself thinking of the First Holy War, the way it had marched into Fainim lands, the mightiest host the Three Seas had ever seen, only to be starved into cannibalism in a matter of months. The great ordeal, he had come to realize, was no different. The cracks had opened, and fate had set the wedges as surely as shipbuilders striking boards from felled trees. What was cracked could be hammered asunder. The army of the Middle North, especially, seemed to be marching under a pall of imminent disaster. And yet, time and again, at least once every week, his Lord and God called him to his spare leather-paneled bedchamber in the umbilicus to sit and discuss madness. It troubles you often, that day in Shima. That day in Shima, when Kellus had been acclaimed Aspect Emperor, Proyas found himself clearing his throat and looking away. 20 years had passed, 20 years of toil and strife, and yet the image of his old tutor, standing derelict before his holy Aspect Emperor, plagued him as insistently as ever. A memory like a childhood burn, not quite stinging, but too puckered not to probe with idle fingertips. I loved a commune. How could a boy, especially one as curious and precocious as he had been, not love his first true teacher? Children can smell the difference between duty, which is merely a form of self-regard, and the temper of genuine concern. A commune taught not to serve, but to teach, to arm an errant boy against a capricious world. He taught young Master Proyas, and not the Cynrian king's second son. But it troubles you, Kellus said, that a soul so wise and gentle would so condemn me. He was a man spurned, Proyas replied on a heavy breath. No cuckold possesses a wise and gentle soul. He remembered a commune coming to him, coming back from the presumption of death, when the First Holy War lay besieged in Karaskand. He remembered his own cowardice, how he spared himself the heartbreak of watching the sorcerer absorb tidings of the impossible, news that Esmenet, his wife, had abandoned hope and turned to the warrior prophet's bed. Even still it troubles you. The exalt general gazed at his lord and god, pursed his lips against the difficulty of admission. Yes, so much so that you read his compendium. Proyas smiled. For years he had wondered when Kellus would call him out on this small secret. I read a summary of its charges against you. Do you believe those charges? Of course not. The holy Aspect Emperor frowned as if troubled by the vehemence of his denial. He lowered his gaze to the fire twirling in the arcane octagon of his hearth. But why would that be when they are true? The small, seeing flame wheezed into silence. The exalt general stared at his lord and god in breathless bewilderment. The simplicity of his garb, the scriptural profile of his face, long-featured, profound for the archaic cut of his beard and hair, wise for the clarity of his gaze, the lingering glow about his hands, as if unseen clouds were forever breaking above them.
What are you saying?
That men are children to me, precisely as Akamian claims. As you are father to us. Anna Sarimba Kellus regarded him with the utter absence of expression. What father murders so many of his sons? What was this melancholy? What was this doubt? After campaigning so long, surviving so much calamity, how could the man, who gave meaning to it all, ask such corrosive questions? A divine one, the exalt general declared. The Shank waxed more bold in measure with their hunger. Soon, not a day passed without a word of some violent encounter. When they dared scout or patrol at all, the Kidruhil did so in force, stung by the loss of two entire companies. One of them captained by King Coithis Narnal's youngest son, Agaban. The army of the Middle North began marching and camping on the ready. During the day they assembled into a vast, mile-long chevron, with the heavily armored Thunieri at the point, the Galeoth on the left flank, the Tidoni on the right, and all the baggage scattered behind and between. During the night they arrayed their camps in tight, concentric circles, with a full quarter of their numbers assigned to defend the perimeter of rotating shifts. Drills were scheduled at irregular intervals to ensure that each man knew his place. Habitual laggards were publicly whipped. The last companies to the line were assigned to the latrines. Despite their growing exhaustion, the men of the ordeal took to singing as they marched, Zadunyani hymns for the most part, but folk songs from faraway homes as well. Some were ribald and merry, others melancholy. But one song in particular, the Beggar's Lament, became especially popular. In some cases, groups more than 1,000 strong would cry out, bemoaning everything from the boils on their rumps to the pox on their members, only to be answered by thousands more complaining of ever more outrageous afflictions. One man in particular, a Galeoth Agmunderman named Shoss, became famous for the hilarity of his lyrics. And so the army of the Middle North marched into the horde's shadow, laughing. No such humor could be found in Caeutus's evening councils. The Prince Imperial always began by insisting he had no news of home, so preempting the inevitable parade of questions. His conferences with his Holy Father, he explained, were too rare and too brief to permit such questions, especially when the challenges they faced were so grievous. The supply situation had become perilous, so much so that rationing had reduced the slaves who marched with the ordeal to less than half of the fare they needed to recoup their daily expenditures. Indeed, diseases of malnutrition were beginning to claim them in ever greater numbers. Dozens were lost every day, either to death outright or to the straggling wastes behind them. The presence of slaves, Caeutus reminded his commanders, was but one of the many concessions his Holy Father had made to appease the Cas nobility. Them. Soon, he would demand they sacrifice in return. The Prince Imperial bid them to recall the First Holy War and the infamous slaughter of the camp followers. When the time comes, each will kill his own, he said. Each! Those who fail to do so will be executed in their slave stead. Remember, my brothers, cruelty is only injustice in the absence of necessity. Compassion, generosity, these are fast becoming gluttonous sins. He did not need to speak the obvious, that unless their foraging began providing game in far greater quantities, necessity would be upon them in a matter of days. They did not even possess pasture enough for their ponies and beasts of burden, thanks to the drought and the scourging of the land. As always, the discussion returned to the reason for their straits, the horde. Caeutus pulled his cavalry commanders one by one, drawing martial wisdom from their observations, tactics to draw them out for easy slaughter, how the relative starvation of the creatures predicted their aggression, and the like. There was no doubt, the Prince Imperial informed his charges, that the Shrank were becoming more desperate, and therefore more bold. He explained the way the snows accumulated in the high mountains, week after week, season after season, until the snow beneath could no longer hold the snow above. They will come crashing down upon us, he said, and when they do, they will not be cowed so easily as they are now. They will come, and they will come until you cry out to the gods for respite. How many are they? King Hagram asked. There was no missing the imperial mathematicians, as pale as sorcerers beneath their parasols, riding out with Anasarimber Moengus on their daily forays. More than us, my friend, far more. King Narnal, who still grieved the loss of his beloved son, chose this moment to voice a sentiment common among his peers, that the breaking of the great ordeal had been ill-advised. "We should stand together," he protested, "shoulder to shoulder with our brothers, divided they can engulf and overwhelm us one by one. But if the great ordeal confronts this horde entire—" "We cannot feed ourselves as it is," the Prince Imperial answered. "We are gathering far more fare as four than we could as one, and still we hunger. To stand together is to starve together." Though his reasoning was sound, Caiudas could see that Narnal, in the course of framing his argument, had sparked real fear in the hearts of his commanders. "Trust in my father," he pressed, "who has foreseen and planned for all these dilemmas. Think of how 50 of your knights can rout a mob of thousands. The shrank, battled, and crazed masses, bereft of design or coordination. You need not fear for your flanks, only stand your ground. Hack and hew!" He turned a gesture to his sister, Anna Sarimba Sirwa, the Grand Mistress of the Swayali, whose beauty was ever a lodestone for idle eyes. "More importantly, recall the schools and the destruction they can rain down upon our foes. Have no fear, my brothers. We will cobble the horizon with their carcasses." And the lords of the ordeal filed from the council, striking their chests and crying out in renewed resolution. So easy it was to kindle the lust for blood in the hearts of men, even those thrown more than 1,000 miles from their home. To look at skies bright and arid, and to sense a darkness unseen. The men of the ordeal marched, little more than shadows in the sheeted dust. Knowing what gathered in the distance, they gazed ever forward, pondering what they could not see. There is an exhaustion peculiar to hanging threats, a needing to confront that tires the soul, the way overstuffed packs sap the limbs. They would look out across the blasted plate of the Istuli, and they would wonder at the rumor of their enigmatic foe. The horde. They would argue numbers, exchange speculations, discuss battles waged by long-dead men. It became a game for some, counting the hundreds of dust plumes that marked the Kidruhil and the various companies of knights that patrolled ahead of them. They would wager rations on which plume marked who, a practice that became so common that some companies found themselves returning to the shouts of uproarious thousands. For the pickets themselves, it seemed they had come to the ends of the earth. The ground was all but gutted dust by this time, so the horde had always appeared as a peculiar dust storm that spanned the horizon, one tethered to the irregularities of the earth. Ochre clouds piled upon billowing foundations, a great curtain that climbed into a haze that stained the northern sky, obscuring the lower constellations at night. Streamers preceded it, tails of gauze, hooked as though on nails, marking those clans that had fled the longest, starved the longest. On and on it extended, powder raised into sinuous mountains, beautiful for its slow-blooming complexities, wondrous for its mad scale. A sense of impunity had grown among many of the riders, one of those thoughtless convictions that arise when something expected perpetually fails to arrive. They rode their trackless circuits, and the unseen hordes before them retreated, always retreated. This was simply the way. Then some trick of the Gungan Naru would kick open a door across the distance, and the windy hush would suddenly tingle with the sound of the horde, a roar that was at once booming and thin. "Like shrieking children," one of the Kidruhil captains would explain to General Caiudas. "For the life of me, they sound like shrieking children." Or, more rarely, given the sheer number of companies pacing the horde, one of the retreating streamers would reverse direction and begin racing toward one of the slender fingers of dust that marked the pursuing cavalry companies. Then the choreographed race would begin, with the company pursued turning back to the main host drawing the reckless clan ever farther from the horde, and so delivering it to the lances of those companies flanking. The battles would be so one-sided as to scarce be battles at all. Ghostly riders pounding out of the smoke of powder-dry earth, riding down the shadows of shrieking Shrank, some so starved as to be little more than dolls of knotted rope. Men with chalked faces would congratulate one another, exchange petty news, then ride on with whatever trophies they so prized. Originally, they tallied the dead, thinking this means of measuring the Shrank's defeat. The squads would always be sent back for the gratification of the host, their lances heavy with severed heads. The counting was abandoned after they reached some 10,000, for who bothers to count inexhaustible things? The practice was forsaken when the trudging infantrymen began jeering at the lancer's approach. The hearts of men are like buoys. The more water you give them, the higher their expectations swim. All that would survive of the custom was the use of lance as a term for 12 Shrank, the average number of heads that could be carried on a standard Kidrahill shaft. And so did a kind of unspoken accord arise between the men of the ordeal and the Shrank of the horde, a truce whose falseness lay in the meagerness of the former's rations. The footmen of most nations had been reduced to gnawing amicate. Every morning the number of slaves abandoned to die climbed a handful of souls. Camp would be broken, and the army would begin crawling toward the northern horizon, leaving several dozen forlorn and broken souls sitting amid the detritus, waiting to be claimed by whatever it was that ailed them. Many just vanished, and the vassals of different lords began trading rumors of midnight murder. Some tales, like the story of Baron Hunrilka, demanding his thanes dip their beards in the blood of their slaves, transcended bounds of kin and vassalage, and were traded through the ordeal as a whole. Fewer and fewer fires glittered at night, for the Shrank horde had so raked the earth that the judges forbade the binding of grasses, or anything else that could be used as fodder or fuel. Here and there, enterprising souls would raise fires of thistles and scrub, but for the most part, men whiled away the watches in apprehension and gloom, uncounted thousands of them, sitting in small, shadowy bands, with only the nail of heaven to reveal the worry in the eyes around them. It was a soldier's nature to accumulate grievances over the course of a campaign. In civilized lands, where marches were brief and battles quick in coming, a commander could rely on either victory to cleanse the ledgers, or defeat to render them moot. But this march was unlike any other, and the surrounding wastes offered nothing to ease the frustrations of a warlike heart. They believed still, for they were Zadunyani, and they feared the judges enough to stay their tongues. But they were simple men, and so thought the solution to their travails was simple. Battle. They need only close with their inhuman foe and hack them to the ground. Earlier, when the horde had been more novelty than existential threat, the lords of the ordeal had hoped that one of the Ishtuli's many rivers would catch the Shrank, as though in a bottle, forcing them to close. But the severity of the drought had choked even the greatest of the Ishtuli's rivers into muddy channels. The horde fled across them as though they scarce existed, fouling the waters with their waste as they did so. And so was the great ordeal thrown open to disease, dread Akiagni, who reached through the most seizing men in his pestilent hands. Sick columns were formed, ever-growing formations that trailed each of the four armies. They quickly became pageants of death and misery, men marching with heads slumped, many of them naked from the waist down, their backsides stained with blood and feces. Hemoplexy was far and away the most common ailment, as well as the most deadly, given the lack of clean water. Only in the madness that is war could men die of thirst through drinking, and so did many learn what poets and historians left unspoken, that more warriors die in offal than in blood. And still the Shrank continued to fall back, a mad seething that scarred the very curve of the world. More and more clans fell upon the companies of horsemen that shadowed them throughout the day, attacks that fooled several captains into thinking the Horde itself descended on the ordeal. Miles were lost to their false alarms. Of the innumerable skirmishes, two in particular became famous. General Soroyan was already notorious because of the way he and his Famiri rode into battle bare-chested, and because of the legendary beauty and speed of his mount, Fireless. Since his Famiri could easily outdistance the Shrank, he began riding ever closer to the Horde, threading the dust streamers that marked the straggling clans, so close his men's necks were pained for gazing up at the mountainous skirts of dust that obscured their foe. "It is like riding into canyons of smoke," he told King Proyas and his war council, "a land where storm clouds war directly with the earth. The shrieks are too many to sound of shrieking. The world simply rings. And then you see them like a plague of insects clodding the ground, leaping, sprinting, massing without order or reason. Madness. Threshing madness. Only the outermost are visible, so they seem frail at first, such as the proportion of the dust piling above them. But then you catch glimpses of the countless thousands swirling beyond, and you know, just know, that what you see is but the edge of screaming miles." The edge of screaming miles. This phrase in particular would find itself passed from lip to lip, until fairly every soul on the army of the East had heard it. Knowing that he would arouse the creatures, the Famiri general took care to coordinate his expeditions with King Regent Nirbanu Soter and his Einani. Arrayed some miles in advance of the army, Soter's heavily armored palatines and their household knights would await Soroyan's howling return. They would wonder at the thin thread of half-naked Famiri flying across the waste, and the mobs of leaping shadows that pursued them. They would open alleys for the men to flee between, then they would close ranks and begin thundering forward. And so were the Shrank felled in the thousands. When these tales reached Sibawal Te Nirwal in the army of the Middle North, he commanded his Sepalorans to strip off their armor, reckoning this was what enabled Soroyan and his Famiri to outrun the creatures. Bent on redeeming his earlier failure, he passed informal word to several caste nobles and Kidrihil captains that he planned on repeating Soroyan's tactics, allowing them to destroy the creatures by the thousands. What he failed to realize was that the uneven accumulation of Shrank before the army of the Middle North meant his horses had far less fodder than General Soroyan's. The Sepalorans rode into the smoke canyons as the Famiri had, wheeled as they had wheeled when the Shrank began racing toward them, and fled as they fled, howling out with the same exhilaration. But their ebullient mood quickly faltered. Once again the Shrank closed upon the laggards among them. Sibawal commanded his hornsmen to signal for assistance, but the general had not discussed contingencies with any of the lords or captains who commanded the jaws of his trap. The inhuman masses gained on the rearmost horsemen, shrieked in obscene triumph as the first stragglers were pulled down. Men crouched in their saddles, whipped their ponies bloody, swept as the slavering masses engulfed them. Some 2,000 of Sibawal's kinsmen were lost to the gibbering pursuit. It would be the first true disaster suffered by the great ordeal, and so did the ill-fated general earn a second flogging, as well as everlasting shame in the scripture that would survive. As the days passed, the shape of what had been an unthinkable fate had become clear to anyone who pondered the ordeal's straits. They faced a more mobile enemy on open terrain, and this meant doom. They could not close with their foe, and as a result they could not secure the supplies they needed to survive. Tales of various historical battles, especially those involving the Skilvendi, the famed people of war, began filtering through the host, traded between shrugging men and pensive looks. More than one antique emperor, the men of the ordeal learned, had led the pride of his people to doom on distant plains. "Fear not," Caiudus assured his commanders. "They will attack, and soon." "How?" King Narnal asked. Bent by the death of his son, he had grown ever more bold in his questioning, ever more insolent. "How could you know?" "Because as much as we hunger, they starve." "Ha!" the greybeard Gelioth cried. "So they will come to steal food we don't possess?" Caiudus said nothing, content to allow Narnal's own harsh intonations condemn him. "We," King Bukyelt erupted, "we are the food, fool!" At some point, each of the marshals of the four armies petitioned the Aspect Emperor, asking that he address their host and so silence the growing presentiment of doom. He rebuked each of them in turn, saying, "If your nations cannot endure trials so paltry without my intervention, then truly the great ordeal is doomed." And so the men of the ordeal roused themselves at the interval's morning toll. They tightened their belts and war girdles, shouldered packs that always seemed one stone heavier than the day previous, and they trudged to their assembling formations, wondering at the dust that puffed from their steps. Some continued blinking long into the morning, whether from weariness or airborne grit, like men trapped in nightmares. Solwheel had no brothers, a fact that had caused him no little shame in his childhood. He had no clue as to why he should feel responsible for his mother's failure to bear a second son, or for his father's refusal to take another wife after his mother died. From time to time he would hear his father arguing with some wizened advisor about the frailty of the dynastic line. "But if the boy should die, Harweel?" He would slink away numb and bewildered, oppressed by a curious sense of urgency, as if he should don his toy armor, do everything he could to safeguard his precious pulse. And he would think how much easier it would be if he had a younger brother. Someone to protect. Someone to share the future's terrible burdens. And so he grew up searching for brothers, and asking for more that dogged his every friendship. He was the prince. He was the one ordained to ascend the horn and amber throne. His was the indispensable soul. And yet it always seemed otherwise. And now, when he needed a brother more than at any time in his life, he was not even sure he possessed a friend. What Sorweel had feared had come to pass. The Scions had in fact stumbled across a shrank host shadowing the great ordeal. They only glimpsed at it a few times, from what rare heights the landscape provided. A column of vast squares marching in perfect formation. Twice, Aeschylus had cast an air-bending spell that allowed them to scry the host in greater detail. While others busied themselves counting heads, Sorweel watched with breathless wonder. Tiny figures become liquid and large, executing soundless errands utterly oblivious to the Scions and their sorcerous observation. Non-men, the first the young king had ever seen, policed the column's flanks, riding black horses and wearing elaborate gowns of chain mail. Erratics, the mandate schoolmen called them. Non-men, who had gone mad for immortality. Sorweel found the appearance of some of them disconcerting, their faces especially. Since time immemorial his people had battled the Shrank, and so, for him, the Shrank were the rule, and the non-men the perversions. He could not look at them without seeing the heads of Shrank stitched onto bodies of statuesque men. Scarcely 100 of them accompanied the host. Far more numerous were what Aeschylus called Urshrank, a species bred for obedience. "Like dogs to wolves," the schoolman said. They seemed somewhat taller and broader than their wild cousins, but aside from their freedom, They were really only distinguished by the uniformity of their armor, hauberks of black iron scale. The Scions could only guess at their numbers, since they not only crawled throughout the column, whipping and beating their more wolfish kin, but also patrolled the surrounding plains in loose companies of 100 or so, the way men would. No matter what their numbers, they were but a pittance compared to the unruly relatives. At first Sorweel could scarce credit his eyes, gazing at the great square formations throughout the schoolman's lens of air. Shrank, chained to shrank, chained to shrank, and on, snapping, soundlessly howling, shambling through screens of dust. Aeschylus counted 100 heads aside, which meant that each square contained some 10,000 of the creatures. Arguing glimpses through the endless veils of dust, he and Captain Harnilas decided that no less than 10 squares composed the column, which meant that Sorweel witnessed something his people knew only from legend. A horde whipped and shackled into the form of a great army. "A yoke legion," Aeschylus had said, speaking with a survivor's dread. "The erratics and Ursrank," he explained, "would drive their wretched captives until the scent of the ordeal sang on the clear wind, then simply strike the chains that threaded their shackles. Hunger would do the rest. Hunger and diabolical lust." The consult was real. If the unmasking of the skin spy in the umbilicus had not entirely convinced Sorweel, this most certainly did. The Aspect Emperor warred against a real enemy, and unless the Scions could find some way to warn Caeutus, the army of the Middle North was doomed. They had spent a crazed fortnight trying to catch the army without dying. They had struck eastward, slowly bending their course to the north, riding day and night in the hope of skirting, even outdistancing the consort host. Within 3 days they found the great track the army of the Middle North had beaten into a dusty waste, but the urgency that spurred their flight was easily matched by the dread host. Day after day, no matter how hard they pushed their ponies, the smear of dun haze that marked the 10 yoke legion on the horizon stubbornly refused to fall behind them. After the first week, the miraculous endurance of their Ji-U-Nati ponies began to fail, and Harnilas had no choice but to leave more and more of their company hobbling on foot behind them. The rule he used was simple. Those he deemed strong riders went on, those he deemed weak were left behind, regardless of whose pony failed. Obotegwa was among the first to be so abandoned. Sorweel need only blink to see the old Setyothi smiling in philosophic resignation, trudging through the dust of their trotting departure. Karampa and other Scions who were not bred to horses were quick to follow. Aeschylus was the sole exception, even though the others began calling him Pony Killer. Every other day, it seemed, his paunch broke another pony's strength, and so doomed another Scion to trudge alone on foot. He felt the shame keenly, so much so that he began refusing his rations. "I carry my pack on my waist," he would say with a forced laugh. The remaining Scion began watching him, in exasperation, and in some cases, outright hatred. The fifth pony he lamed, Harnilas chose a tempestuous Girgashi youth named Barabul to yield his mount. "What?" the young man cried to the mandate schoolman. "You cannot walk across the sky?" "There are Kuya on the horizon," the sorcerer exclaimed. "We are all dead if I draw their eye." "Yield your shag," Harnilas bellowed to the youth. "I will not ask again." Barabul wheeled about to face the commander. "There will be war for this," he roared. "My father will sound the high sh—" Harnilas hefted his lance, skewered the young man's throat with a blurred throw. The Kidrahil veteran spurred his pony in a tight circle about the dying youth. "I care not for your father's," he called to the others, resolution like acid in his eyes. "I care not for your laws or your customs, and apart from my mission, I care not for you. Only one of us needs to reach the Holy General. One of us! And the great ordeal will be saved, as will your fathers and their fool customs." The huffing schoolman clambered onto Barabel's pony, his face dark with the rage that weak men use to overmatch their shame. The remaining scions had already turned their backs to him, resumed their northward drift. Barabel was dead, and they were too tired to care. He had been insufferably arrogant anyway. Sorwill lingered behind, staring at the body in the dust. For the first time, he understood the mortal stakes of their endeavor, the mission his insight had delivered. The scions could very well be doomed, and unless he set aside his cowardice and pride, he would die not only without brothers, but without friends as well. The company rode in haphazard echelon across the plain, each pony hauling skirts of spectral dust. Sarongo rode alone, relieved of his brace by the steady loss of their mounts. He hung his head, his blinks so sticky as to become heartbeats of sleep. His mouth hung open. They had ridden past exhaustion, into mania and melancholy, into the long stupor of mile stacked upon endless mile. "I'm next," the successor prince said with offhand disgust as Sorwill approached. "The fat man eyes my mebby even now. Eh, mebby?" He raked affectionate fingers to the pony's plumed mane. "Imagine the Sadakan of the High Holy Zeum, stumping alone through the dust. I'm sure we'll find—" "But this is good," Saranga interrupted, raising a hand in a loose but yes gesture. "Whenever my courtiers air their grievances, I can say, 'Yes, I remember the time I was forced to hobble alone through the shrank-infested wastes.'" He laughed, as if seeing their faces blanch in a soul's eye. Who could whine to such a Sadakan? Who would dare? He had turned to Sorwill as he said this, but he spoke in the inward manner of those who think their listeners cannot understand. "I'm not one of the believer kings," Sorwill blurted. Sarongo blinked as though waking. "You speak Shaik now?" "I'm not a believer king," Sorwill pressed. "I know you think I am." The successor prince snorted and turned away. "Think? No horse king. I know." "How? How could you know?" Exhaustion had a way of parting the veils between men, not so much because the effort of censoring their words exceeds them, but because weariness is the foe of volatility. Oft-times insults that would pierce the wakeful simply thud against the sleepless and fatigued. Sarongo grinned in what could only be called malice. "The Aspect Emperor, he sees the hearts of men, Horse King. He saw yours quite clearly, I think." "No, I don't know what happened at the—" He had assumed his tongue would fail him, that his Shaik would be so rudimentary that it would only humiliate him. But the words were there, cemented by all those dreary watches he had spent cursing Aeschylus. "I don't know what happened at the council."